Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Matt Hall. Welcome, Matt. It's good to see you.
It's good to be here.
Today, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University and co-chair of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network Steering Committee, about the hunt to identify diseases that have defied diagnosis. I think this is going to raise lots of questions, and that's a good show. We may not have all the answers, but Dr. Shashi certainly has a bunch, and looking forward to that. First, though, let's talk about some research that matters. And the first one has to do with being empathetic. Would you describe yourself, Matt, as an empathetic person? What would your wife say?
Probably not.
And is that because it takes too much emotional energy?
I think it's because it takes a lot of effort, right, to understand the emotions of another person, or at least that's what we think.
Yeah, I could certainly understand the way you're feeling. That'd be an empathetic statement.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I have these conversations with my wife lots of times, and where, you know, we'll be talking about something and all I really want is a little empathy, and she wants to fix it.
Exactly.
You know, it's like a surgeon's mentality. Well, we can fix that right now. And it's like, well, no, I don't need it fixed or something. And I think there's a lot more to this empathy than meets the eye. And this is research that was actually in the Journal of Experimental Psychology General, about 11 experiments on empathy with more than 1,200 participants. What were they looking at and what did they find?
So they basically wanted to see whether or not people would prefer to make decisions or describe a certain events in the context of empathy or as just describing what was going on. And they found that most people chose to just describe the event rather than put the effort or the perceived effort in understanding the deeper emotions that people were experiencing.
So in these deck of cards, where one characteristic would be just to describe what you're seeing in the card, and the other is to, you know, say something empathetic, people would choose more often the descriptive cards rather than the empathetic cards that would require them to say something empathetic.
But what I think is also really interesting is that they followed this up and they found that if they told people that they had a high scoring empathy or a high score on an empathy rating system, and people thought that they were empathetic, right, that they were more likely to choose that deck of cards later on.
So if you were told you were empathetic or good at it, you were more likely to be empathetic than if you were told you're not really particularly empathetic. So if I said you're not empathetic, Matt, you would say, yeah, he's probably right. But if I said, you know what, I think you've been really doing good at the empathy, you might think, oh, I can do this.
Exactly. And that can have implications, I think, on how we approach other people, which is pretty important.
Yeah, I think that this is kind of like it is playing musical instruments. It requires practice. Mm-hmm. And empathy can be taught. And we teach medical students and residents how to be more empathetic, because we know that it makes you a better doctor. I think we can teach our children to do this, and we ourselves can learn to be better.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, which really is about something that's near and dear to me, which is employee wellness programs. And this is something that's happened really all over the country, where employers of small, medium, large are really trying to produce a healthier workforce, not only because it lowers out-of-work costs, improves productivity, but also because of the cost of healthcare going up and trying to control them. What do we begin to learn from this research, perhaps, or not?
Well, this article basically is talking about BJ's Wholesale Club employees who were enrolled in a wellness program for a number of years, and they were monitored to see if enrolling into this wellness program, where they would get some type of benefit from being in the program and exercising, eating correctly, whether that saved money for the system.
But they actually only followed them in this study for 1 year.
1 year.
So
yeah.
1 year to say if we could reduce cost after 1 year.
Right. So very limited period of time. And in that limited period of time, they found that it actually didn't significantly reduce the cost of medical care.
But they did learn to exercise more. They learned to maybe lower their weight more. But the short-term outcomes weren't radically different, which begs the question, well, I don't think anyone who runs, and I run a program in a wellness program, expects that short-term outcomes in just a year, you're going to see the overall benefit that you might get from getting people to quit smoking, which takes years, getting people to lose weight, which takes years, altering their blood pressure, altering their diabetes.
Right. This is really should be looked at as an investment in people's future, and that you're putting this effort in right now and so that your employees 5, 10, 15 years down the line will be healthier, will live longer, and have better lives.
Yeah, and I think that they're seeing expansion of these programs to look at things not only about like blood pressure and smoking, but things like depression and emotional health, perhaps being empathetic to some of the plights of some of the employees. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, our next research that matters looks at what we understand at the cellular level about how things work and don't work. In this particular case, it's about a food additive, actually, that could influence how flu vaccinations work well, which we know that sometimes they don't work so well.
Right. I think just in clinical practice, sometimes it's hard to convince people to have immunizations, especially against the flu, and they're having it every year. And then there's questions about how well they work. And this study kind of was seeking to explore that. And they looked at this additive in food and they studied it in mice and looked at an equivalent amount of use of this additive in mice, whether or not that made a difference in fighting influenza when they were vaccinated. And they found that there was significant impairment in their ability to utilize the vaccine, meaning that they got sick or that they didn't respond as well as they should.
Yeah, it's interesting. This additive TBHQ3 or tert-butylhydroquinone is found in actually kind of common products like cooking oils and frozen fish and processed foods like chips. But yet this was done in mice.
Right. And a lot of studies start off in animal models because they are more convenient and it's easier to work with than in humans. And it's important to note that most of the time, those findings don't necessarily translate into human effects.
And what we end up doing with it, even if it were true, it would maybe suggest that is this additive, can it be removed? And I do think understanding better why the flu vaccine is only effective in half, 40% of the people who take it is a really important research. Speaking of important research, this last research that matters has to do with survival after a heart attack, where if you have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, not just a heart attack, but a cardiac arrest, your heart stops beating and you're outside the hospital, only 6% survive to hospital discharge. And yet getting these AED, these defibrillators, to people earlier, we know saves lives. So what's the problem here?
So the problem is that they're just not available enough in this in the world. I think that if anybody looked around them right now and said, where's your closest AED, they'd have a hard time finding it. And this study is really saying that we should bring the AED to them.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
Through not a taxi, not an Uber, not a Lyft, but through a...
Through a drone.
A drone.
Which is quite groundbreaking technology.
Wow. And I'm just trying to visualize it. But you know what? There's lots of things I probably couldn't visualize 5, 10, 15 years ago. So this is bringing AEDs through drones to where people are at. And would it help?
They're projecting that it would increase that 6% to up to 12% survival rate if they were able to fully implement it, and which is actually 13.8%, even higher than what I thought, which is pretty impressive.
Now, this is based on a simulation. This isn't based on actual clinical trial or doing research. And before perhaps policy was adopted, you would like to see this maybe tried in a county or some limited basis before you adopted this all over a state, unless it's maybe no more expensive than what you're currently doing, in which case maybe do the laboratory of an entire state.
Right, right. The I think like starting it off, and they make the argument in this article that starting it off initially in a smaller area and then expanding it would allow us to really explore the benefits of this new resource.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University, about the hunt to identify diseases that have defied diagnosis. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Matt Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matt Hall. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University and co-chair of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network Steering Committee, about the hunt to identify diseases that have defied diagnosis. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Shashi.
Oh, thank you.
It's good to have you here, and I think there's so much to cover here and to think about hope and healing for so many families and questions and research. But I think we'd first like to know a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in medicine and research and in pediatrics and in pediatric research?
So my interest in medicine goes back to my father having had major health problems, including diabetes, hypertension, and myocardial infarction at a very young age. And taking care of him led to the question of, should I do this for a living? And so that led to me to go to medical school. And in medical school, I became interested in pediatrics. Kids, to me, are so resilient. And taking care of kids gave me a joy that I didn't find as much in other specialties. So, and then when I was a pediatric resident, I did a genetic selective, and that had me hooked. I liked the intellectual exercise in trying to figure out a constellation of signs and symptoms in order to arrive at a diagnosis. And this was at a time when the, you know, expansion in genetics hadn't yet occurred. And since I've started that career in genetics with the advent of genomic sequencing, we've been able to unravel the causes of so many adults and children who have rare and unexplained phenotypes, because most of them have very rare undiagnosed genetic diseases. And so that kind of became my focus within my career. And then when the Undiagnosed Diseases Network was being formed back in 2014, we applied for one of those and got funded as a site at Duke. And so my work has continued along that line.
What was one of the first cases you remember seeing that maybe piqued this interest in genetics? You must have seen something clinically. I can't imagine that you didn't.
A while ago, I would say in the early 90s, there was this young child and this is just one example. It wasn't one child that crystallized this decision for me, but this was a young child who had very severe epilepsy. And it was clear that all the known causes that we could look for that involved things like an infection, could there have been a trauma, could there have been birth injury, and none of those were potential causes. And then after some diagnostic workup, it was clear the child had a deletion on one of her chromosomes that led to it. And that made me think that, you know, this family finally had an answer. It didn't lead to any specific treatment, but it opened up the doors for potential down the line, some answers as to specific treatment. It also gave them clarity as to what their chances of having another child with a similar type of epilepsy and other problems this child had would be. And that intrigued me. I felt like, you know, I was a partner with that family in their journey to trying to find a diagnosis. So that was the kind of patient that made me want to go into this field.
Dr. Shashi, I was wondering if you might be able to tell us a little bit about a recent breakthrough you've had and how that came to you and how it progressed.
So this is, I would say, maybe 3 years ago, as I was, you know, getting more into this field of using genomic sequencing as a way to diagnose these very difficult to diagnose patients. We had a young child who came into the hospital here at Duke. I happened to be on call and consulted on her. And she had this very sudden onset of ataxia. She'd been a healthy 15, 16-month-old who suddenly became ataxic. And that means having unsteadiness while she was walking. And around the same time, her parents noticed that her eyes seemed to be dancing in the eye socket. So that's called nystagmus. And this led to a number of investigations and ultimately hospitalizations because it was obvious this wasn't getting better. And soon after that, she developed weakness of her upper extremities to the extent that they were almost paralyzed. And so on her eye exam, she was found to have some changes in the back of her eyes as well, that there was some visual impairment that was also manifesting itself. So the combination of those things with no other obvious explanation made the possibility of something that was genetic come to the forefront. And we were just doing a study then looking at genomic sequencing as a way to diagnose children where we didn't have any other way of explaining their symptoms. So with the family's consent, we enrolled her and her parents. And we expedited the sequencing because this child was also undergoing a lot of treatments for these symptoms on the presumption it could have been an autoimmune disease. And so they were looking at chemotherapy as the next option for her if things weren't getting better. So we expedited her sequencing and found that she had two gene changes in a gene that was responsible for a genetic form that explained all of her symptoms. It was a rare genetic disorder called BVVL for short. It's called Brown-Violette-Van Leer syndrome, and she had two mutations in that gene, a very rare disease. Less than 80 patients in the world had been described previously with this disease. And so the point of this story is we had a diagnosis for this child that said that this wasn't an autoimmune disease. We also had a potential treatment because the gene that's responsible for this disease is one that is responsible for transporting riboflavin, which is vitamin B2, from the blood into the cells. So if this transporter doesn't work, there's a deficiency of riboflavin or vitamin B2 in the cells that cause the neurological symptoms. So we decided we were going to treat her with very high doses of B2, and we started that treatment the weekend after we got our results. And this child made a miraculous turnaround. Her unsteadiness improved. Her eye movements got better. The weakness of her arms improved significantly, and today she's a healthy child who's in school. She still has some signs and symptoms of it, but there's been no further progression, and she's recovered most of her function. Whereas the natural history of this disorder would be continued involvement of the neurological system to the extent that most patients with this die of the disease. So that to us was a huge breakthrough that we could use these technologies to save a child's life. And for her, this vitamin B2 is a medicine that she will be on for the rest of her life, but it's a medicine that keeps the disease, you know, from manifesting itself any further.
You know, it's really quite remarkable. You talk about a disease you're able to diagnose but not yet treat, the disease you're able to diagnose and treat, and this giving of hope through a process that you talk about, genomic sequencing. Can you explain in terms that maybe perhaps a country family doctor like myself could understand what you're doing and how you can do that today, but you probably couldn't do it 10 and 20 years ago, and how that's done?
Yeah. First of all, I think you're underestimating yourself. So genomic sequencing actually has been around for a long time. President Clinton, funded the Human Genome Project, but it took a long time and a lot of money, close to $3 billion, I think, to sequence a genome. Since then, technological advances have made it possible for this to be done in a much shorter period of time. And because the technology is so widespread, it also becomes cheaper over time, so the cost has dropped exponentially. So probably for the last 7-8 years, we've been able to do it on a widespread basis. It's also commercially available. It's available on a research basis. So essentially what the technology does is, you know, we have about 20,000 genes. And the DNA is in those 20,000 genes. If you look at the part of the genes that make the protein, that's called as the exome, that accounts for about 1-2% of those genes. So that's about 3 million letters we have. And if you sequence just those coding parts of a gene, it's called as exome sequencing. And most of the rare diseases we talk about, you find mutations within the exome, within that coding part of the gene. So that's the technology that we use a lot now. There's another aspect to sequencing, and that is called as whole genome sequencing as opposed to whole exome. also in whole genome sequencing, you sequence every part of that DNA. So across those 20,000 genes, every letter of the DNA, that amounts to about 3 billion letters. You sequence all of them. So that includes the coding and the non-coding parts of the gene. So that's done more on a research basis, and we do that as part of the network I am. We also do the whole exome. And the understanding there is, sometimes you may have non-coding mutations that also cause certain diseases. So you're kind of expanding or improving upon the yield from whole exome to whole genome sequencing.
Yeah, that's exactly how I would have. That's exactly how I would have described it. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke and co-chair of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network Steering Committee, about the hunt and success to identify diseases that have defied diagnosis, and hear really a lot more about this unidentified disease network. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Matt Hall. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University and co-chair of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network Steering Committee, about the hunt to identify diseases that have defied diagnosis. Dr. Shashi, I was wondering if you might be able to tell us a little bit more about the Undiagnosed Diseases Network.
Sure. The Undiagnosed Diseases Network, also called as UDN for short, is an NIH-established network. The network was first established in 2014, and it consists of, at this point, 12 clinical sites that are spread across the United States. And these clinical sites can accept applications from patients who, across the country and even internationally, who have signs and symptoms that have defied medical diagnosis. And so the patient can apply to the network, and their applications are reviewed by one of the clinical sites, usually based on geography and also based on local expertise. And if the site determines that they can actually help the patient, they will accept that patient. And then the patient travels to that site and spends between 3 to 5 days at the site, where they undergo a number of diagnostic procedures. When I say procedures, I'm not just talking about invasive procedures. I'm using that as a process. So the patient would see a number of consultants who may be able to help identify the signs and symptoms and potentially suggest differential diagnosis or suggest further laboratory testing. The patient also undergoes those laboratory tests, and if there are specific things such as imaging or echoes that need to be done, all of that is done. And once they are seen by this team of physicians, if the feeling is that this is probably something that's genetic, which tends to be the case for over 80% of rare and undiagnosed diseases, they tend to be genetic in origin. So if there is a consensus that they would benefit from genome sequencing, that is also done as part of the network. And it could be either whole exome or whole genome. Now, if family members need to be enrolled, that can also be done, and multiple people can be sequenced. And then once we get all of those results, if there is a diagnosis to be made, that is communicated to the patient, the referring provider, and ultimately the patient is transitioned back to their referring physician once we have all the results back. Now, the clinical sites are supported by a number of other sites in the network. The network also consists of a coordinating center, and the coordinating center manages all of the activities of the network, such as getting the applications, routing them, etc. There's also a biorepository where we can store samples. Because this is a research study, we get a lot of biosamples that might help us research further whatever the diseases that we may identify in patients, so that is also there. And there are 3 sites in the network that serve as core laboratories for further animal modeling. Since the focus is on genomics, many of the times we identify new disease-causing genes. And the way to prove causality and pathogenicity sometimes involves functional work, and the animal modeling sites can help us with that. We also have a core that does further metabolomics work. It's looking at biomarkers that might be suggestive of metabolic disorders. That's also part of the network. So we all work together. We share data across the sites. And the whole goal of the network is to facilitate diagnosis and to also facilitate further research into the patients and the diagnosis that we make.
It's not every day that we have a guest on our show who has diagnosed a new disease and even has it named after them. Could you tell us the story behind the development diagnosis of the Shashi-Pinna syndrome?
Sure. So this was a patient that came to the UDN. This was a young man, or I should say young boy, who had had developmental delay. He had had some learning difficulties associated with that. He also was fairly tall for his age. Now, being tall is a good trait, but sometimes it can also indicate that you're growing at a faster rate than is typical or expected. And he had a few unusual facial features. And so the underlying suspicion had been that he had something genetic. But testing had not confirmed that there was an underlying diagnosis. So when he came to the UDN, we had had his prior, he'd also had a whole exome done before. We had had that information and we kind of reanalyzed that exome data. We do that a lot. If somebody's had previous testing, rather than repeating it, we try to reanalyze the raw data, especially when it comes to genomes and exomes. And he had this interesting candidate gene called ASXL2 that we thought was interesting because there was some mouse data that if you knock out this gene, it causes some developmental disorders, defects in the mouse. And then we thought that's a good gene. And also it belongs to a family of three genes. The two other genes in this family, ASXL1 and ASXL3, had been linked to developmental disorders that kind of overlapped with some of the features we saw in our patient. So we thought that this was an interesting gene. And one of the things that happens in genetics a lot these days, and this is not unique to the UDN, but there is a matching program for genes called as Gene Matcher. It's like a match.com for genes. So if you're a researcher who has a gene, we call these as candidate genes when you think it's a new disease gene, but you don't have enough evidence to declare it as that. You can put in that gene into this program. And if any researcher or clinician around the world has put in that gene as their gene of interest, it matches you up. So we did that, and very soon we came across researchers across the world, really, who'd had an interest in this gene, and some of them had patients with findings in this gene, just like our patient had a variant in this gene we were interested in. So very quickly, we had a group of about six patients, all of whom had overlapping clinical features, and all of them had changes within this gene that would cause this gene not to work as well. And all of these findings were new, meaning that none of the children who had these variants inherited from their parents. They were what we call as de novo events, meaning it happened as a new change within the child, so it wasn't part of the family. So very soon we had enough evidence and we did some functional work to show that this protein is affected by this gene product. The gene mutation does cause a difference in the protein product. And so very clearly we had a new syndrome that involved distinctive facial features, had developmental delays. Some children had epilepsy, some did not. And so very soon we were able to declare this as a new disease-causing gene, and we published it. And once we published it, we have kind of a big clearinghouse database in genetics called Mendelian Inheritance in Man, where every new gene and every established gene is cataloged along with the signs and symptoms that go along with it, the mechanism of disease. So that particular database then called this new syndrome we had described as Shashi-Pinna syndrome. Shashi is, of course, my name. Dr. Pinna is my close colleague who had worked on this with me at Duke. She and I were co-first authors on this paper, so the syndrome was named after us. It wasn't of our choice. So,
well, we think it's appropriate, and I bet it for those whom you've made this diagnosis, it is life-changing. So thank you.
I was wondering if you might be able to tell us what kind of advice you can offer patients who are perhaps dealing with an undiagnosed condition.
So one thing to remember is many of these families and patients feel very alone because they've gone from physician to physician. They've sought medical advice. They've had medical procedures, tests, and there's no answer. One thing I would say to them is you are not alone. It might seem like you're alone. Collectively, these undiagnosed and rare diseases are supposed to affect about 30 million Americans. So while individually each disorder may be very rare and might affect people from a few hundred to a few thousand, collectively they are common. And so there is a big community that's developing now around patients who have these rare diseases. When they're diagnosed, they become entities. But for people who are undiagnosed, my message is you are not alone, although it feels that way. And I think there's also a lot more hope now for making diagnoses with increasing technology such as sequencing, as well as other fields in medicine, you know, evolving, the diagnosis rate is going up. So there's hope to get diagnosed. And for some disorders, there could be a change in management depending on what we diagnose. And for many rare diseases, there are a lot of clinical trials that are going on, some that are developing, and there are patients who made foundations for their disorder that are trying to get involved in research. So there's a lot of hope on the horizon for patients who are going through this journey.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Vandana Shashi, for bringing hope and healing possibilities to families that otherwise may not ever be able to get it in, as well as the entire network that you work with. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
We've been talking with Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University, about the hunt to identify diseases that have been undiagnosed and defy diagnosis. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matt Hall. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Matt and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. Anyone who'd like to send us a question or a comment can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's one word, yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My toddler got a high fever about a month ago, which then led to a seizure. His pediatrician has given us the all clear, but it was actually pretty scary for me, and now I find myself anxious that any moderate health issue might all of a sudden turn into a serious problem like it did with the seizure. How worried should I be about another unexpected complication?
Well, this is a tough issue and one that I think it would be very natural to be concerned about. It's very scary when your child has a seizure when they're febrile. And we should say, you know, for our listeners that these febrile seizures, these seizures associated with high fevers, they occur usually when a child has an infection, most frequently a viral, could be bacterial, and the children are usually between 6 months of age and 5 years of age. They don't have really any other explanation, like underlying epilepsy or other more serious central nervous system areas. And so those things have to be distinguished. But let's say that this was done by the doctor and that was diagnosed. We'll take that for granted. What other things just kind of come to mind? What kind of questions, Matt, would you want as a parent or even a provider?
So one of the most common questions would probably be like, is my kid going to have seizures for the rest of their life?
Yeah. And the good news is that this does not mean your child will have seizures. It does mean that they're perhaps at a higher risk of having it than in the general population, but it's only just above the risk in the general population. So it's not a very high risk. It may mean that when your child has developing a fever in a setting of another infection, that you might want to treat it with acetaminophen or children's Advil to lower the fever and lower the risk. And so that may be something useful. But then you also say they don't actually need to take anti-seizure medications. Mm. Those would be some, I think, common things that people would want to know about.
Yep, absolutely.
Certainly talk with your primary care doctor, and if you have any questions, you could certainly see a pediatricologist, but most cases don't need that done once you know it's a febrile seizure.
Yep.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 47, and I'm having shoulder surgery. It will also be the first time that I've ever received anesthesia. What should I expect, and if I were to have a reaction, how would the providers know that?
Well, hopefully the anesthesiologist would be the first one to know that. And in your experience, how do the anesthesiology approach these sorts of things?
Well, generally when you're preparing for surgery, you should have a meeting with either the anesthesiologist or with a technician who's going to help you through the paperwork and processing you into making sure that it's safe to receive anesthesia. And during that process, they'll also give you some information about possible outcomes or adverse events that might happen and can address your concerns at that time.
Yeah, and the good news is if you're young and healthy, the likelihood of this is low. But I remember we were talking about some research that matters not too long ago about the rising use of marijuana. And this was in Colorado, and that under anesthesia, because of the marijuana use, that people's tolerance is higher and they need more anesthesia. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of something that you probably want to at least communicate, both what you're taking that's prescribed and unprescribed, to the anesthesiologist.
Absolutely. I think being as honest as possible is incredibly important, especially when we're talking about your health and your safety.
Thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Recently, I was playing soccer and I tripped and fell and felt a snap in my big toe. It was swollen, and by the next day, it seemed to be bruised. A friend of mine said that a doctor would probably just buddy tape it, even if it had been broken. But I'm curious if I should see my doctor or an orthopedist, given how painful it is.
Okay, on the count of three. One, two, three. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I think this one is one that we, in most cases, think is a pretty important thing to do. I mean, I guess there could be some circumstances in which you'd really, the doctor doesn't think it's broken, may not necessarily need to. But I think if you're concerned that big toe's broken, there's a decent chance that seeing an orthopedist might be helpful.
Right. I think at the minimum, definitely see your primary care provider, and they'll be able to make the decision whether to see a specialist. I think people underestimate just how important your toes are in walking around and in balance, and you don't want to mess with those.
And because there can be complications, that big toe, that can, if it you know, it goes over the joint area, it can cause arthritis, it can not heal correctly, it might need a surgical intervention, pinning, other things. That big toe kind of acts a little differently frequently, and it's much more important in some respects. Mm-hmm. Fractures of those other toes frequently can be treated with buddy taping. Mm-hmm. This might need a boot, it might need some more therapy. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I was recently diagnosed with Bell's palsy. Will the droop in my face ever go away?
Well, this is, another tough area, because this is something that, you know, people see. You know, we know depression is really difficult, but a lot of times people don't see when you're depressed, or you see you might have high blood pressure. People don't see you have high blood pressure. But this is something that people see, but it doesn't cause too many symptoms, but the symptoms aren't great.
Right. And what people see is that basically half your face is kind of paralyzed. And people sometimes notice this when you smile. If you have Bell's palsy, only half your face will smile. Or if you try to open your eyes, your one eye will be drooping down. And it can be pretty jarring and scary when you first see it. I think that if you notice those symptoms, you should 100% see your doctor immediately and get it properly diagnosed.
Because if you get it diagnosed, that the treatment you might start, and that treatment might actually prevent it from becoming complete and reversible.
Exactly.
And that's what you really want to avoid, because it could start over a day or two, but it might take 2 or 3 weeks to get its maximum element there. And certainly if it's full recovery, then you probably don't need further imaging or further studies done. However, I think talking with your primary care physician about whether or not this is a sign of something else, because there are a lot of things that can cause Bell's palsy, ranging from, we don't know, idiopathic, to diabetes, to tumors, to other things.
Yes. Yep. So definitely getting a professional to take a look at it and not just thinking that it'll be going away sometime in the future, I think is incredibly important.
Well, we want to thank everyone today for really some really good questions, and we hope that we've been able to give some answers that help explain some of these questions. We also want to thank today our great guest today, Dr. Vandana Shashi, professor of pediatrics at Duke University, for all that she brought to helping us understand the issue of these undiagnosed diseases. We hope that everyone today has been able to learn something from your health. And any question or concern that you have, you can actually send it to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org or on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. I want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and the great guest co-host today, Dr. Matt Hall. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Matthew Hall.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.